He got us again. What? He got us again.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Fuck me up, Coulson.
This is a book club. We're going to drink some alcohol. We're going to talk about some books. We're going to get a little petty. My guests are Debbie Millman, Open Mike Eagle, Mira Jacob, and I am Roxane Gay. We're here to talk about an incredible book. Well, at least I thought it was incredible. The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. MacArthur winner, Guggenheim fellow, blah, 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 Pulitzer, whatever. He can also write, except for one thing, and we'll get into it. It's a story of justice gone awry and also about redemption. It's about a young man who is working and living with his grandmother.
Harriet.
Which, what a good name.
Yeah.
And his name is Elwood. And you become very fond of Elwood as you start to see how this young man who is falling in love with civil rights and then has all of his civil rights taken from him, and still he doesn't lose hope. He hitchhikes on his way to college, his first day of college, and is arrested because the car is stolen. And then he goes to a reform school for boys, and his life changes forever. What is your gut reaction to this book? The just thing that makes you go, ugh.
I don't know that I can destroy me.
Yeah. Oh, God, this book. This book destroyed me. Nothing like reading a book on a plane that makes you weep uncontrollably to a point where the flight attendant comes up and says, "Dear, are you okay?"
Oh, no.
And then you have to look at her with sort of big, swollen eyes and say, "No, actually, I'm not.
I'm not, and America is fucked."
I felt seen.
I didn't feel seen, but I did feel, I feel uniquely tied in this way to America in a way that I feel like I can never outrun again.
You know, I'm not one who traffics in hope all that much because I don't know that hope has served, especially Black people, well, historically. But I do admire the ways in which hope is a through line throughout the novel.
But I think it's an interesting cross-section because you're seeing a boy who's aware of the social factors, but also being given this source of pride from the civil rights movement, this burgeoning. And he's getting this outsized sense of who he can be. And he's and that sense of self is constantly at odds with everything around him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing that I can't kind of stop seeing in my head is when he would sit and he was waiting for a moment where people like him would come into the dining room of the building his grandmother worked in, right? So he would watch that door swing open, waiting for the moment in which he would see anyone that looked like him there. And he never saw anyone but the workers. But just that image of the door opening and closing and all his hope behind it was so, I just felt like it caught a lot. It caught a lot about that moment where you wait for things to change. Your whole self wants to be present for it because you really want to see when it's going to happen.
He continues to see what he wants and what he deserves.
Always, yeah.
And he can never quite reach it. And the closer he gets, it's also the farther away he gets. And I thought that Colson Whitehead did a really good job in really showing, in many ways, the hopelessness and the futility of trying to create change.
After that devastating arrest, when he's actually en route to a college class where Elwood is just so proud of what he's been able to manage over this short course of his life thus far, for that to be thwarted before it even starts, for something he didn't even do, felt so criminal and so bereft of any humanity that I couldn't actually believe that I had to experience it. Mm. That's how painful it was. And at that instance, I thought, I don't know that I can make it through this book if it doesn't get any better.
Even if you look at the circumstances by which he got arrested, he had to hitchhike because his bike was broken.
Right.
Which happened in the altercation with the boys when he tried to stop them from stealing in the store that he was working in. And I think that kitchen, that whole scene, that job he had where was it even really a job or was he just helping out? But
it was this race or the contest that had been crafted to essentially trick him.
And I think that's so foundational to who he is, too.
Yes.
Yes.
He finds something that he can do that he shines at, it, some sense of merit. And he gets so into that and wraps his identity around that so much where, like, that same industriousness, that same dignity is what ends up being his undoing over and over again all throughout his life.
And how he works so hard to win these encyclopedias and finds out once he takes the box of encyclopedias home that they're fake, they're phony, I think is a wonderful metaphor.
And it was interesting to see, like, in many ways you wonder, were they trying to protect him by crushing it in him themselves, that light and that ambition, because they know what the world would do to someone like him? It's one thing to know the world is a cruel place and it's not going to help you and that the world does not care about you. But I think that you, especially with children, you try to preserve their innocence for as long as possible, and there's nothing wrong with that. And this highlights what I think a lot of us who are people of color know, which is that we are not afforded innocence. It doesn't get better. You know, sometimes we like to believe it gets better, but in this book, it's kind of relentless that it doesn't get better. But I suspect it's also true to life.
So I have a question along with that, which is, why did you keep reading?
Because the prose is magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
On a sentence level, everything was crisp. I could imagine the reform school.
Mm-hmm.
I could see the hotel. I could see Harriet and the curve in her back from her fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a character or a place or a moment that I did not feel tangibly. And I kept thinking, this movie is going to be amazing.
It's such a vivid book. You do actually see each incident so clearly, so crisply.
Mm-hmm. It's very cinematic. Why did you keep reading?
You know, it's really interesting because when you say that, I'm aware of the weight of my own hope as I was reading the book. And I'm also, I think it's really interesting, right, to build a narrative where you know that at least a good portion of the audience in America is going to come to this for a redemption story, right? All the people that love Green Book want to know, right? They want to know in which way is this going to affirm some part of our humanity so we can feel great about this story. And so he's running in the face of that. And he's building a narrative that subverts that in a lot of ways. But what it made me do, what it indicted in me, was the weight of my hope, frankly. I kept feeling the tug of my hope and my need to, my like fraught need to have something okay happen to these kids. We talked before, I got a 10-year-old son, you have a 10-year-old son, and you talked about what do you do when you have a kid and how do you, you know, it's not fair to take their innocence from them. And that's absolutely true. It's also terrifying to think that you're not preparing them.
Right, for the realities of this world. And Elwood was not prepared
in
any way. But I do think Harriet tried to prepare him. And I commend Whitehead for not giving us that hope we crave, because I too, even though I know better, I was just like, maybe he's going to get free and he's going to expose the school and he's going to become like president.
This is the story of Barack Obama.
Exactly.
Just changed the name.
Exactly.
I think that in a way, narrative-wise, he did do that though. Because, and you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but the way that it reads as present day, a person reflecting on their history, you're reading this as a person who's made it through this. The reason that I kept reading it, because I've never experienced an author paint what it's like to be a Black introvert. In this kind of urban setting. I've never experienced a book that laid out what it means to have that rich of an internal life that runs counter to everything else that's around you. And that resonated with me.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked in a place that's like Nickel. It's, you know, it was earlier this decade, so the conditions, of course, are very different, but it's the same kind of place. A lot of it is based on keeping kids in line. A lot of it is based on occupying them with work and not really teaching them very much. And you know, what it means to graduate is being a good citizen. As a lot of what's reflected in this book, these are facilities that still operate to this day, just with different conditions.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Nickel Academy is fictional in this novel, but there are Nickel Academies in every state.
Well, Whitehead talks about how it's actually based on a real place in Florida.
It is. That author's note, which I always read the author's note because I'm always interested in if there is an author's note, seeing how did they come to write this particular story. I think that also makes reading a book like this painful because you know this is a fictional story and you can set it aside, but the reality is that young Black men are being put through these systems, and young Black women for that matter as well, and they are being neglected and they are being abused and they are not being given a second chance.
Yeah, I mean, what I was struck by in the author's note was the fact that the discovery of the bodies on the grounds when this school had been sold and then purchased by an entrepreneur that wanted to rebuild, these bodies get discovered, these skeletons. The notion that Elwood comes in, one little boy, and then comes out quite another on so many levels, was part of what was so chilling, to watch that he even knew that he was changing, that when Harriet does come to see him, and he's so torn because he so wants to tell her what's happening but knows that he can't, and beseeches her to see him with his thoughts, see me, and tries to excuse the abusers by imagining that when they go home, they're not like that.
Right, they're different
people.
That
they're only like this in that environment, and then realizes, no, they are evil.
Yeah,
they are like this all the time.
He only has a good understanding of the world, that he's willing to see the good, even in the people who have done him so much harm. And, you know, one of the things about books is that I am very particular, and I can't stand a prologue because I'm just like, call it chapter one. Like, what is happening here? You do not need a prologue. But this prologue was interesting because it sets up that we know terrible things are going to happen, because it starts with these anthropologists finding these dead bodies, and then you have to wonder, who are these dead bodies? How did they come to be buried in this shallow ground? And so what did you guys think of the prologue and the kinds of work that was being done in that prologue?
You know, when you were talking about it's the Dozier School, I think, in Florida, right, is the real school. That prologue actually was incredibly helpful for me in the way that I feel like so much of my last 10 years has been trying to stitch together the history that I've never been told about America with the history that actually exists. And this felt to me like, okay, this is a place. This is a place that you don't know about. This is one of those things that you'll read about in a news story. Mm-hmm. And it'll be one of 100 news stories. And it'll go right through you because your body only has so much of a capacity to take it. But this is actually the moment to sit with this particular story for this particular place.
I agree that this does open a door, because we do read a lot of news, and especially in this day and age, every minute there is a new and more horrifying news story. Mm-hmm. And things that would normally be on the front page for a week or 10 days, now not even an hour.
Yeah. Right.
And that's what fiction does. I think it engenders empathy in a way that journalism, which is incredibly valuable, can't right now.
They don't have the space to give the context.
Correct.
Yeah. I ended up going back to the prologue at least 2 more times after reading it first throughout the book, to remind myself what I already should have known, to make sure I knew it. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't entirely sure how important every single line was the first time I read it. And so when I went back and forth, it helped me as the reader ground myself. It reminded me a little bit of the family tree in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's
Where you flip back and forth.
100 Years of Solitude, where I had to keep referring back so that I could keep track.
But don't you like that moment?
I do, but I felt vulnerable in not being on my reader's game, that I had not somehow remembered better. That the writer deserves more. The writer deserved more from me, that I should have been able to keep up. Oh, and so that made me feel bad about myself, that I'm not able to keep up here.
I will also say, reading that prologue and then getting to the part where it was 2014 in the book, I don't know if you guys had that moment, maybe you didn't, but I feel like my heart sort of turned over on itself, where it kind of had made sense of the full arc of time. Did you do that too?
For me, it did. It definitely was like a bookend. Like, yeah. This is why we started where we started.
Yeah.
And so everything came full circle. And I enjoyed it both as a reader because everything fell into place.
Yes.
And then as a writer, I was irate because I was like, how dare you be this good? Mm. Because I am petty enough to say it.
That's good. Yeah. Embrace your petty.
I honor and nurture it. And I just could not believe how he had done that, because oftentimes with a prologue, and that was the case here, you forget where you begin. Mm-hmm. You forget that you begin with this story, and then that he brings it back. And then I remember where we started, and I actually went back to look at the prologue again, and then I was just like, oh, I see what you did there.
I'm not good with prologues or first chapters of most books because I go into them blank. I hadn't read this author before. I didn't know anything about this book. So I go into a prologue, and like you say, it's jam-packed with information. And my brain doesn't instantly know what to retain
exactly.
And what to leave behind.
Exactly.
But as we were prepping for this, I kind of went back through the prologue, and some of these sentences are, they make my blood run cold now, mm-hmm. having read the story.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, there lived a nickel boy who went by the name of Elwood Curtis. Like, that's so innocent and so nuanced.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is.
And like you have to reread it yes. once you read it, yeah. Like because that sentence alone shows you like, oh,
yes,
he told us from the beginning.
He told us.
Mike, what was the other line you wanted to share?
There were just two more sentences. He'd do a web search on the old reform school now and then, see if there were any developments, but he stayed away from reunions and didn't add his name to the list for many reasons.
Yeah.
And then
all of the reasons.
When they found the secret graveyard, he knew he'd have to return.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because when you first read this book, you're just like, oh, this is interesting.
Right.
Wonder where it's going. And then you're like, when are we going to get to the real story? And then you realize after you read the book, the real story was in front of us yes. the entire mm-hmm. time.
Absolutely.
Are we allowed to, can we talk about
yeah,
the,
we can talk about
let's
the
talk
twist.
About the big, let's talk about the twist.
I did not see the twist coming, I must say, and oftentimes I can see a twist.
Mm-hmm. No, I was reading, and the twist comes, and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What yeah. just happened? What yeah. just happened?
I mean, yeah. and usually a twist is in service of a story that's not that interesting.
Right.
You know, with,
right.
in this
yeah,
case,
it's twist a dream.
They know that this is the right. last thing that they have, this is the last chance they have to do something useful. But
this, right. he's already beaten no. my heart to hell.
But it's so nonchalant.
Yes.
It's
yes.
almost, yes. you almost could read past it.
That's yes. true.
Yeah. If you really could, if you weren't paying know. Attention, if you were a little high,
like,
you're like,
what?
Anything could happen. It blew my mind, and it for so many reasons, because Turner was such an interesting character, and he was clearly like the more savvy and the more aware of the circumstance. Like, he was the realist to temper Elwood's optimism
right.
throughout, and they developed such an intrinsic bond throughout their incarceration. I kept thinking, oh, this is not going to end well for Turner.
Me too.
Right.
The way it was set up, I just thought, poor Turner, the world is not, you know, he is not long for this world. And turns out he actually was long for this world. And it, the way it happened was so fitting. I was rooting for him as Elwood
mm-hmm.
and as how he tried to live up to Elwood's name and Elwood's being. The way he did that was, it just, oh, it made me feel a lot.
I feel like we're set up that way in stories. In America, mm-hmm. we are set up to think that it's the axe is going to come down on the Turners.
Yes.
And it's going to let the Elwoods escape.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, that's what it is.
And
is
it's
that,
part of that hope narrative that we were talking about
earlier. It's part of the fantasy about race
like
in America.
Like, that we believe that the meek shall inherit, that
yes.
good will overcome,
right.
cream will rise to the top, meritocracy, it's all connected.
Of it. All of it.
And no, sometimes that's not the way it goes. So we've talked about what we love in this book, but no book is perfect. And one of the things that drove me to Distraction, well, there are two things. He used the word cement when he should have used concrete.
Oh, that's a big pit peeve
that's a big
of yours,
thing
Roxane
for me.
Gay.
But setting that aside, the portrayal of women in this book was not good. I thought the women were oftentimes very one-dimensional and very archetypal. They were backdrops for men to learn things about themselves or to represent certain ideologies.
Mm.
And it was not subtle. And I think we see this a lot in fiction where women get short shrift
but men are these hugely developed, fully realized characters that get to have dreams and get to be introverted or extroverted and get to have their hopes dashed. And the women are just sort of, they put up with the men at all times and they suffer and suffer and suffer. And we see that at play here in terms of Harriet and later in terms of Denise and then in terms of Millie.
Right, but it's agency too, mm-hmm. right? There's nothing that they want other than the men in their lives.
Yes.
There's nothing that they think for themselves other than about the well-being of the men in their lives. So that was frustrating. I think the other thing that was really frustrating for me was just at one point, he's talking about how white men learn from their fathers how to treat black people. And he says they learn how to keep them in cages. They learn how to humble them. They learn. He goes through the interiority of even the white men. And I was like, where is that for the women? Mm-hmm. The women get nothing. The women get no interiority
at all. They don't even seem to have any desires. They don't seem to have a favorite food. It's just,
yeah, the women in this book were certainly treated as background characters.
I have to disagree. I don't think that they're given the full interiority and agency, for sure. However, I feel that Harriet helps form Elwood. For a little boy like Elwood, who's been abandoned by his mother and his father, to still be that curious about the world, to still have that much hope, means that she was quite good at parenting him.
Yes, but I think that's the problem. Her entire existence is in service of Elwood.
But it is.
But like, what if she, but no one's entire existence should be in service of anyone.
I mean, she dies.
But
a year after
that's the problem.
But that's not a person.
That's not a person.
That's a
martyr.
But she was. I think she was. And I don't
and
think.
And so was Millie?
Well, I don't want to get to Millie yet.
But
I want to
finish. Let's talk about what all of these women have in common.
Harriet is doing that because that was what she felt was expected of her. That was what gave her life meaning. That's not a fault of Colson Whitehead's writing. He's intending for her to be this way. Whatever sense of self he actually has. How else would he have found it if she didn't do that?
The way everyone finds their sense of self, just through life, through trial and error.
But not at that little boy, not at that age. He had so much potential so early because of Harriet.
No, I mean, I don't think that's true.
So you think he was just born that curious?
I do think he was actually born that curious. And I also think that when she gave him those albums, she wasn't intending. Remember, there's a line in there about how, oh my God, how did she give him these specific albums?
She regrets it.
She regrets it. So no, I don't think. I do think that he was naturally curious. I also think that even if she was a woman with agency, the idea that that would somehow take away from his growth is preposterous to me. Like, she could have, it could be both.
But it's a book about a boy in a boy's school.
Yes, but when the women are there, there are significant women in his life nonetheless. And those significant women deserve better than to be summarized with one or two words.
I don't think that Harriet was summarized with one or two words. I think that Harriet was a very rich character. I think what's interesting about what Colson does to Harriet at the end is that she dies a year after Elwood does. And that
as a martyr.
As a martyr.
That bothered me. I will say that bothered me. But when Turner looks up Evelyn to find out more about her, Colson does not include the father in that. He doesn't include the father in that. He only looks up what happened to Evelyn. I think that's telling.
Yeah, I have a question. What about the agency, unpacked or unexplored or not, the agency of his mother?
Oh, what happened there?
Well, then that's the question for me, because that characterization was a complete curveball to me. I've never seen
okay,
that.
So we should talk about this. The parents are whisked off the stage very quickly. We know them as shadows, right? Mm-hmm. We know them as two people who decided to go west without their son.
But I'm asking specifically in terms of gender characterization, because if that had just been the father, we wouldn't have thought twice about it, because that's something we've seen in real life and in fiction. I've never seen a mother do that in a story, not or maybe not as impactfully as I saw it this time.
And it wasn't explained, it wasn't unpacked. Mm-hmm. And there was this line about Harriet thinking about Evelyn and the look that would be on her face when she was nursing him. And I'm like, damn, that's interesting. It doesn't get unpacked, but I did think it was something novel.
The boredom.
Yeah. I've definitely seen it before, but I agree it's rare that you see the mother abandon the child. And that's interesting, but again, it's just one note.
Yeah.
All she is the woman who abandoned her child. I know that's not the point of the novel, and this is actually a very lean book. And so I think it's lean for a reason, because he had the discipline and the focus to focus on Elwood.
Sure.
Yeah.
But that said, this idea, abandoned mother, mm-hmm. and—
But the abandoned father is just as thin. In fact—
But other male characters in the book are super nuanced yeah. and rich.
Given this is a sensitive topic, but it's starting to form in my head. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking now, outside of Elwood and Turner, but Turner by some weird trick, mm-hmm. Outside of Elwood and maybe Turner, is there any character in this story that's not kind of one note? Even the rest of the men mm-hmm. maybe only service the story in a flat fashion.
Oh, for sure. That's a very good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think Griff is a bit more...
Which one's Griff from
Seven? The fighter.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But here's
and also the white guy, the
Spencer,
the painter guy, the guy who took them out to do the work.
He was complicated. Mm. Haley.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But here's this line about Harriet. When he gets in trouble for going to the protest, Harriet resorts to an old Johnson family recipe for the silent treatment, one that dated back to Reconstruction and achieved a complete sense of erasure in its target. She instituted a ban on the record player. I mean, I think that there was some sense of her dignity that is at play here. And her agency. So I still will disagree with about Harriet. I do feel that Denise and Millie are one note. But Harriet has more than one note.
I feel that it's a note that we've seen so often. The long suffering black woman who is
the matriarch.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Only the family that she's had and lost.
The strong black woman archetype is right. alive and well in this novel. Yeah. And it does such a disservice to black women because this becomes the exemplar of how we're supposed to behave. Like, oh, yes, we're supposed to be able to withstand losing our loved ones at an alarming rate for Harriet. Like, poor Harriet has not caught a break in her life. And at the same time, I get that that is representative of reality, especially during the Jim Crow era. But oh my goodness,
but isn't she allowed
I crave
to be
for so much
it?
More.
Isn't her, she allowed to be resentful?
Yes, like why is
isn't
she just like, well, I'll go back to work. I'm like, girl, what?
Her suffering does start to inform her character after mm-hmm. a while. It seems like every choice that she does make after a certain point is because she's lost so much.
Yeah.
But that's also, I think, what makes the juxtaposition of Elwood's hope and optimism so much more vibrant, that he still seems to have that despite, I mean, he has that until the very last moment of his life.
Well, because he gets to be a fully realized character. Like, no, I don't think anyone disputes that. It's just that I wanted the same for Harriet. Okay. The reality is that, especially throughout the mid-century and just beyond, people, especially black people, there was hope, there was joy, there were these moments, despite the realities of racial oppression and despite segregation and despite ongoing and pervasive discrimination. And so, did she have friends? Mm-hmm. Did she have mm-hmm. a faith community? Mm-hmm. Did she have a hobby? Like, we just don't know any of these things. Now, some of that is the limitations of her role. It's not her novel. So we're not necessarily gonna know all of these things, but give us something.
He is so subversive in so many other ways. Mm-hmm. It is kind of glaring that there was no subversion
exactly.
of the gender expectation.
Exactly, like, and I see this with a lot of the prominent black male writers. Black women come last in their narratives, and whether fiction or nonfiction. And most of them are criticized for this, but we give it a pass because, I mean, look at what they're doing. Look at these towering achievements. And like, what would be a towering achievement would be for these writers to step up and give black women some dignity in their pages.
Part of what upset me the most about this book was how Elwood treats Denise. Mm-hmm. Because that, to me, felt like a defining moment of evidence of his actually being broken. Up until that point, he treated no one badly.
Do we see him treat her badly?
He admits to treating her badly.
But do we see it happen?
I think that there's an engagement in their sexuality and in the drinking, and I do feel that it was less than respectful.
What was the lady's name at the end that he was with?
Millie.
So he certainly gave her less respect by continuing the facade. She got a lower quality him.
Yes. Millie did or Denise did?
Denise
and then Millie had a lower version of him until he came forward. Mm-hmm. And that's why she gets so angry. Like, we've spent all this time together. We've built this life together. And now you tell me I don't even know who you are. And that was great. And I was like, yes, like, let's see more of this. Because everyone, like, any woman in her right mind would probably be like, I understand why you did what you did. But I need you to go think about what you did.
Mm-hmm. The 15 minutes.
Yes.
The 15 minutes where she says to him, I need a minute. Mm-hmm. And she takes 15 and goes away. I was like, thank the Lord.
Because if she had just embraced him, I would have just been like, girl.
Then I would have agreed that was absolutely absurd.
Let's just give her 15 minutes of being herself.
She doesn't fully come around even until the end. There's a line or two when he's about to go off on the airplane where there's a sense that there's going to need to be a repair in this relationship, that this duplicity has harmed it.
For sure. Like, it's not a happy
home. But it only makes sense in knowing that it's really not Elwood, it's Turner treating Denise the way he's treating him. And when we see Elwood treating Denise the way he is, I'm disappointed in Elwood. And maybe that is a reflection of the lack of richness in Denise, that I don't actually feel bad for Denise. Right. I feel bad for Elwood having been beaten down to a place where he then isn't as kind as he could be.
But that's real.
No, you're right.
He's
treating someone
poorly and you're feeling bad for him.
Yeah.
That's what I'm acknowledging.
And the thing is, I wanted to be able to feel bad for both of them, because when you know what they've been through, those both Elwood and Turner, there's, without proper therapy, which I'm a big fan of, there's no way that they could truly be functional in relationships. And so I was willing to have empathy for him and for his bad behavior. I wanted to have more empathy for Denise, because I knew how she was reacting, because I knew how she felt. And because she was so one-dimensional and we get so little of her, it was hard to even find that space to give her that time and that energy that she deserved. And I think that speaks to an interesting way in which this novel was set up. It's told in multiple parts, and especially toward the end of the novel, it goes back and forth between the time at the Nickel Academy and then Elwood / Turner living a life out in the world. And we see how this man is able to overcome the most impossible circumstance and make something of himself and try to make a life for himself, but still he can never stop carrying the weight. And I think the structure of going back and forth really allows us to see just how heavy of a burden it is.
I agree. I think the one thing that was missing for me was really understanding how Turner is able to become who he is. If it were Elwood, I would have expected him to overcome the hardship. I didn't feel like I knew enough about Turner's interior life to be able to understand how he could go from living in a flop house to then becoming a successful businessman. And we never really see that jump. He just becomes the better person.
But, you know, I think that starts from an initial moment we don't get to see, and that's the moment from Turner initially hearing this plan from Elwood about how he's going to bring the whole thing down, and he's giving him the silent treatment like Harriet did, and he was completely against it, to where he decides to not only deliver the letter, but then rescue him. We don't really get to see that internal shift happen, and that line continues on.
And I would have liked to have seen that or understood that in that latter part of the book.
Yeah.
What was the decision? He does berate himself for not burning the letter. Mm-hmm. As if that was why everything happened. Mm-hmm. It's racism. It's not about the letter not being burned. But what got him to understand that about himself was something that I really would have loved to have learned about.
I would love to sit down with Whitehead and just ask,
why didn't you show us more of Turner before this great transition so that when the reveal happens about the twist, we understand,
Elwood even makes a statement about how little he knows about Turner.
Yes.
We know little about Turner.
Turner's a blank canvas, which I think in many ways is what enables him to do what he does. Huh. And I do think, I don't know that I needed it elaborated as to how he does it. I think it's that when he sees Elwood gunned down, and I do appreciate how it doesn't come easily building this moving company and that he has a back pain and that he's never really recovered from his time at Nickel Academy.
You know, now that I think about it, there's something a little sinister about him taking on Elwood's name, too.
That
helps him survive.
Absolutely.
Right. So it's not even completely an altruistic choice he's making right
there. Oh, no, I don't. But and I think that's exactly it. And I think that's what makes it so painful. Like, this is the best choice that he has is to engage in this massive deception. And in many ways, he becomes a version of Elwood. But yeah, I agree. It's definitely not, I don't know that he ever sat around and just thought, I'm going to do right by Elwood.
Yeah,
I mean, that's me, and that's my choice to like put that, imbue it with that sort of hope and optimism.
But there's nothing that gives us the sense, really, that his taking on the persona of Elwood is about him trying to be a better person.
Well, the thing is, I don't think he was ever a bad person. I don't think that he needs redemption in the traditional sense. I think, for me, redemption for him is just overcoming the trauma that he endured. I don't think he has to become a better person because I think that most of those boys at the Nickel Academy were good boys, but they were good black boys, and good black boys are automatically criminalized.
Okay, but we're all writers, right? We're all writers. We know what we leave on the page and what we don't. So he intentionally left Turner off the page. Mm-hmm. So I was asking myself afterward, why leave it off? Like, what does it do in service of the story? Because he can write anything. I mean, I feel like this was so good. It's so rich. He's such a talented writer. It's obviously a choice. It's a choice he made. What do we get when he leaves it off the page?
I think that it's most likely, and I'm not a writer in this capacity.
I'm not a fiction writer either.
But I believe it to be in service of the shock of the twist. Because we're categorizing Turner as we categorize almost every other character in the story. It's kind of his background. By that means, we have low expectations of him. And so we could never expect that this person who we're inhabiting in the present day could possibly be Turner because we don't know anything about him. It's like we don't know anything about most of the characters. So I feel like it does make the twist stronger. But if he had have chosen to give us a little bit more of that, it possibly could have made the story stronger. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to say.
Yeah, and I think it creates what we often seek in others, which is a blank slate onto which we project whatever we want. Mm. And so by leaving Turner and his background deliberately opaque, we get to go along with Turner becoming Elwood and just think, yeah, I can see that.
For me, it kind of gave me the equation in my head of what if hope does not look like what you think it looks like? What if hope looks like something unknowable? Do you have faith for that place? That was sort of the emotional algebra that it did in me, where it kind of made me work through that equation.
I'm thinking of that now. So in that matrix, does Turner become Elwood by taking on Elwood's pride that Turner didn't have before? Is that kind of how that happens? Is that transferred, the same pride that he was getting from MLK speeches that was outsized and he ended up dying behind? Does that then transfer to Turner? And then is that what hope looks like?
I don't think so.
I don't think he took on the pride. I think he just took on Elwood's willingness to believe there is something better. Mm. I think that's what propels him to move to the flop house and then to get his own place, to work in the company, and then to buy it, and then to buy two other trucks, and then to hire five guys.
So is that hope instead of pride?
I think it's more, it's not quite hope, but it's not the opposite of hope. Mm. It's not despair. It's just,
I feel like it's a sort of ethic. It's a spirit almost.
The sturdiness.
He took on the sturdiness. Actually, I think it is the sturdiness. I think that One of the things that I found so remarkable about what they seemed to be searching for was this sense of normalness. And normal, the idea of normal is something that comes up over and over and over again. There are two parts towards the end of the book where, in referring to Chickie Pete, another very minor one-note character, refers to the notion that they had been denied even the simple pleasure of being ordinary. Mm-hmm. Hobbled and handicapped before the race even began, never figuring out how to be normal. And then later, in referencing the time that had passed, Elwood or Turner thinks, all these years out of that school, and he still spent a segment of his days trying to decipher the customs of normal people, the ones who had been raised happily, three meals a day and a kiss goodnight, the ones who had no notion of white houses, lovers' lanes, and white county judges who sentenced you to hell. And that pursuit of the normal.
There's something that was really difficult for me to read in this book that kept coming up, and it's touched on right there, but it's the sexual trauma.
Which isn't ever touched on.
Well, I feel like it's touched on. I do feel like it's touched on enough. I feel like it gets revisited. It doesn't necessarily get unpacked.
It doesn't ever get unpacked.
But you get this contrast of a boy who, at the only moments we show with him and girls are him being nervous to talk to them, where he doesn't have any real idea of conception of what, you know, a romantic relationship is like even. And he ends up in this place where boys are being courted by men in a very predatory way, and that's just part of life. And that trauma, I don't know, that was really visceral for me. Even without it being unpacked, just the hinting at it that
In some ways, I feel like it doesn't give it the respect it deserves. I mean, we feel the whip going into Elwood's legs and the scarring and the fact that the dungaree fabric is then embedded in his skin. And Lover's Lane is referenced several times without any sense of what part did or didn't Elwood have in it, what part did Turner have or not have as part of it. Mm-hmm. And I was waiting for it. I was actually bracing for it.
And in the same way, what was happening to those boys and the ways that their bodies were being used, there are hierarchies that result from that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There are ways that you take that trauma in and it changes the way you feel about love. It changes the way they feel about people around you. It changes the way you treat them. It changes
how you treat your partner.
Right. Changes how you treat your partner, and it changes the way you deal with the other boys that may or may not be having that same experience. It creates its own world, and that world was also something we didn't see.
Right. No, we didn't. And I thought that was a missed opportunity, not because I need to see brutality. I actually don't. I've had enough of brutality in my lifetime. It's more that I wanted to see more of an exploration of what that trauma did to these young men.
Yes. Right.
Because it deserves to be honored. Mm-hmm. And we never talk about young men and sexual trauma.
Exactly.
Even though it happens, especially to young Black men.
One in six.
Yes. And so with one in six young men dealing with this, we talk about women all the time, and I'm all for that as a feminist, but we do need to also talk about the ways in which men suffer. Mm-hmm. And this was an opportunity to do that. And I wonder what it would have brought to the novel to at least acknowledge it a little more than to just keep alluding to Lover's Lane. Mm-hmm.
And I think it also would have helped us understand the relationship between Denise and Elwood / Turner better. And then I would have liked, again, in that journey that we're seeing of his growth and development, well, then how was he able to create a supposedly better relationship with Millie? Where was that growth? What was that inner journey that he took to become a better person?
Mm-hmm. Honestly, at least in terms of the sexual violence and the sexual trauma, I felt like I appreciated the way that he treated it, because to me, he left enough breadcrumbs where, to me as a person, you know, who is a Black man, who has worked in places like that, so maybe I have a different experience with it. But, you know, when the boy who was mixed Mexican and
yes,
Jamie,
when he wanted to hurt Earl,
I knew exactly why that was.
Oh, yes.
Even without him having to say it, like, and that sort of thing, that anger, that willingness to hurt, like, that is what is engendered in those sorts of situations.
And I do appreciate the subtlety of that, because I do think all too often sexual violence is used as the narrative motivation. Mm-hmm. It's used in this really salacious way where the only way I can think of to create drama is to throw in a rape scene.
Right.
And so I am glad that he trusted his narrative faculties enough to not do that.
The Game of Thrones.
Yes.
He didn't do the Game of Thrones.
He did not Game of Thrones it. Do you guys have questions for Coulson?
Yes. What's up with Millie?
What's up with Denise?
What's up with Evelyn?
I like that. What's up with Evelyn?
What happened in Turner? Mm-hmm. Where was the turn in Turner?
Why did Elwood have to die for this novel to work? Would it have worked if Elwood had gone into the world?
I've actually thought about that a lot. Would, without the twist, does this story work?
Mm-hmm. What in an alternative universe could Elwood have become if he made it to his college class?
Mm. Absolutely. Was the title always The Nickel Boys? Because in many ways that speaks to how it's not Elwood's story or Turner's story, it's the story of all these boys. And so did you ever consider any other titles?
And is The Nickel Boys just these two boys? Mm-hmm. Or is it all The Nickel Boys?
Mm-hmm. But look at how the two boys become one boy. In the shadow.
Oh, he got us again.
What?
He got us again.
Oh my God. I'm telling you, this is the inception of novels.
Oh my God.
The inception of novels. So did you have a hand in designing the cover?
Jesus Christ. Fuck me up, Coulson.
Seriously, stop, man. Just you not.
What?
Why are you that good?
My God.
Fuck you. Shit.
We have to take a break and
come
back.
Oh, that really hurt.
I mean, like, I can't.
Yeah.
Oh my God,
that's
like,
real.
Oh my God, my stomach hurts
no,
now.
No, for real, I'm not in my diaphragm right now.
Good of course, eye. The designer Good sees eye. It, and we're all like, my oh, God. I just thought it was a red box.
Right.
Wow. It's a beautiful book cover, by the way.
It is.
Yeah, but I think that the title, why the title?
I want to know which scene you cut. Which one was the hardest to cut?
Because clearly a lot was cut.
Because a lot was
Oh, yeah, this
shape.
Was pared down.
Clearly a lot was cut.
Which one do you miss?
Who's your favorite character in this novel?
Who's your favorite character in this novel?
My favorite character is Elwood, because he was so I just love curiosity. I'm a curious person, and like all of these little tangents he kept trying to go down. Mm-hmm. Like I do that all day with the internet. But he was doing it with one Encyclopedia Britannica.
Like, well, not even a full set.
One encyclopedia. He was like in the encyc. He didn't even have the Lapedia.
Here's a question. So this book was, what year was this, the part the in the past? Do we know what year it was set in?
Martin Luther King was just starting.
So the 60s.
Yeah. 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah, late 50s, early 60s.
The school was started in the 20s.
So what would this story look like if it was set in 2019 and was flashing forward to 2040?
It would look exactly the same.
I think so.
You think so?
Yes.
I think that's
what actually made me so heartbroken, that this is a book set in the 1960s, but young black men are still being incarcerated in this manner and still being used as free labor in this manner.
And are still being killed in this manner.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what I mentioned before.
And these reform schools.
The hate you give.
I guess, because kind of what I'm asking about is, conditions were such in the 60s where you could just tell these families, these boys ran away. You didn't have to have an excuse. You could just murder them in cold blood because you felt like it and dispose of them back behind the shed. And I'm not certain you can do that now, but you could do something analogous to that now. And I'd want to know what that looks like.
Lie.
I feel like it still could happen. I feel like black lives are utterly disposable. And we hear stories, I wouldn't say every day anymore, but almost every week, about institutional malfeasance, where people slip through the cracks, where foster children disappear, where, in fact, in D.C., I believe, there have been a double digits, if not triple digits, number of young black women who have gone missing, and nobody talks about it.
Where are the children that were taken from their parents at the borders?
Right.
Right.
It's happening every day.
And that's happening in plain sight with a reasonable amount, not a reasonable, with at least some news coverage.
Sure.
It just makes me cringe. And I think someone is gonna write a novel about those children. I hope someone does. But more than that, I hope we get those children out. When we think about this book, it's definitely a flawed novel, but it's also this really satisfying story. Like,
yeah.
The part of me that just loves a good story, that doesn't want to overthink a book, just, I went with it. And I always love to know, like, where do they end up? And we get a sense of that, even though there's a deeply ambiguous ending.
I'm going to disagree with you. I think flawed is too strong a word. I think there are some inconsistencies. My opinion is that there are some inconsistencies in some areas where it's thin as opposed to muscular. As a person who does not write fiction, I'm probably ever so slightly more forgiving. I'm not looking at this through a fiction writer's eyes.
Right.
And I echo the same sentiment, not only from not being an author of this sort, but just in terms of a story about a Black male introvert. There's no way I can look at this book or this story technically. Mm-hmm. It just resonates with me on an emotional level in a way that not too many pieces of media ever have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's really all you can ask for from a book. You know, I definitely can nitpick it as a writer, but I read this as a reader.
And this was my joy, actually, with this, was reading it like a reader.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many books where you're standing outside and you're saying, how did they do this? How did they do that? And I know we just did this a little bit in our discussion, but really, in the moments I was reading it, it did shut out the entire rest of the world. I was with this book completely. I did not want to eat or feed my child or talk to people on the phone. I just needed to read this story with an urgency. And it has to be an enormous book at this point to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In this moment.
And I read it in one day.
Yeah, me too.
I just went right through it.
Yeah,
I couldn't stop.
I read it in a handful of hours. I did not want to walk away from it. I found myself walking around my house with the book. Not a lot of books encourage me to keep reading.
It's rare for me to cry while I'm reading. It was something I could not control. I was inconsolable at moments, experiencing the depth of his horror. And it will be a long time before I forget this book.
So if you want to cry and feel emotionally devastated and otherwise obliterated,
this is
by
your book.
All means.
It'll tear you the fuck apart.
The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead.
Let it fuck you up.
Racism. God damn it.
So the book I want to recommend is by an author named Dan Sharness, and it's called The Big Payback, and it's the history of the business of hip-hop music. It starts at the creation of hip-hop as an art form in New York and traces the business of hip-hop, the record labels and radio stations, all the way until the mid-2000s. And I think it's an incredible resource for anyone who's interested in how this very impactful culture has grown and changed in the short time it's existed.
We tell ourselves stories in order to live is the first line of Joan Didion's 1979 book of essays, The White Album. And in doing so starts a book of remarkable clarity, deconstructing everything from the 1970s, the 1960s, feminism, the Getty Museum, and more. And it is a book that has, I think, one of the best book covers of all time, designed by Robert Anthony.
My book recommendation is Dark Thing by the poet Ashley M. Jones. It's a gorgeous book, and it brings up a lot of questions. It doesn't necessarily answer those questions, but it sort of gives me an imperative to do that answering on my own.
The book I recommend is How We Fight for Our Lives by Saeed Jones. It's a coming-of-age memoir that looks at a young man coming to terms with his sexuality, his relationship with his mother, and becoming a man.